Hi, my name is Tracy Cook, and welcome to the podcast series Victim to Victory. We've got a really special guest today, and I've been looking forward to this podcast for such a long time because this series gives a voice to those that have overcome obstacles in all forms, that dare greatly to share their real stories. Amazing humans like our upcoming guest. She's an absolute superstar. I'm so excited about this. Amazing humans that have seen hope and risen above those adversities to become victorious. And we've got a visionary. So they've gone from victim to victory to visionary, believe me, that now support and inspire others to do the same. And boy, do they do that. Now, before we invite them on here, this is Lil Bukowski. So welcome to Victim to Victory, Lil.
Hi, how you doing? Good morning. Well, good morning here in America anyway. I don't know what time it is there.
It's good evening here in Australia, but I want to share some things because I know so much about Lil and we've collaborated together on a couple of projects, but I really want to showcase because I'm going to be hearing bits of her story that I've never heard, and it's such a diverse background as well. So I'm just amazed. I don't even know where to start. When I was reading through the amazing things that you've done, from music and theatre, filmmaking, photography, this amazes me, accomplished drummer and vocalist. My God, worked in restaurants to pay the bills, an entrepreneur and the CEO of a publishing corporation, a definite creative. And just, you know, with that background of theatre and writing and all of that, the most amazing thing is that you're so down to earth, you're so relatable, and you're such a cool cat. Lil, where does your story start?
You want the real beginning?
Okay. Whatever you're willing to share.
Sure. So and I tell this a lot when I do speeches. I sometimes start with this. The truth is, I was born in Jersey City, New Jersey, a very weird place to be born, I guess. But one of my earliest memories, I was 6 years old. My uncle, my father's youngest and only brother, jumped off the Empire State Building. He worked there, and he was very distraught. He'd been married 5 weeks, and it was a very difficult time for everyone. And my father collapsed. I mean, he just became a very difficult, from this happy-go-lucky guy that played with me on the floor and made tents and, you know, made science projects, science teacher, to a guy who was drinking and couldn't get it together. And my mom sent me to live with my grandmother, who was a tough Italian lady who was crippled. So I always say that started my life kind of being almost like, you know, I think in my past lives I was a soldier. But, you know, she leaned on me literally and physically because here I am 6 years old and she limped a great deal, and we'd go places to kind of have to lean on me and have to help her with her exercises for her leg. And my grandmother went through 8 operations in my lifetime to get her legs even. She had been thrown across the street during a hurricane and her hip was broken way back when they couldn't fix it. So I started out living, feeling, you know, kind of abandoned as a 6 year old, having to go live with my grandmother, and my mother would come and visit very often. And sometimes I'd go home on the weekends with her. So I was one of those kids who didn't really have a lot of friends because most of my friends during the school week were home, you know, doing homework. On the weekends, I went back to a city where I didn't know any of the kids. So I think that's where all the artistic stuff comes from, because I started reading voraciously. And I got very involved in old time movies. And I would stay up late at night watching the Late Show and the Late Show. I guess this, all of that. My father was a science teacher. My mother a mathematician, but they were very eclectic people, very artistic. And they introduced me to the theater. And eventually we all came to live together. My grandmother and my father and mother bought a house across the street from my grandparents. So we wound up all living in one place. And it worked out pretty well in the long run. But that's kind of my story. And it really impacted me a lot to have to be responsible by myself for an older woman. She was alone. But my grandfather worked out of state, and he was gone all week. So it was mostly her and I all week long. And we bonded a very great deal. She was much more my mother in some ways than my mother was. But it was an interesting way to grow up, I guess, in a kind of a Italian compound. I have to say, my father was Polish, my mother Italian. So, and, you know, just kind of grew up as a New Yorker. And when you grow up not far from New York, by the time I was 13, I was getting on buses and going to see theater all by myself on Sundays. I would just get a bus and go over and stand if I had to, see shows. And I got very, very involved in music and theater, musical theater. And that's why I went to NYU. I wound up going to NYU. I got accepted in my junior year of high school to go to NYU. So
that is absolutely amazing.
That's kind of where my story starts, I guess, and goes. I got didn't get any less crazy from there.
So you learn from such a young age to be resilient and responsible, but you know, still had this passion that you were getting on the bus. You like where did your mind go when you're watching the theater? What did you see when you were seeing the theater? Did you see like your future, or was it an escape, or what was going through your mind through during those times?
I think I was more fascinated with the technical aspects of it than anything. When I was 13, my one of my father's friends had a daughter who was about 17. And she's very kind of I don't know how to say this. She was very introverted. She didn't have a lot of friends. And I was very sophisticated at 13 already. And she took me to see Jesus Christ Superstar, which is not even to this day one of my favorite musicals, but there's things about it. And I sat there in the theater, I think it was the Alvin Ailey, if I'm not mistaken. And there was no curtain, there was a wall. And as the wall started to tip back, people started to slide from the top of it onto the floor. And these crazy creatures were coming over the wall on ropes, and the whole thing collapsed and became the floor. That was their idea of a curtain. It was brilliant. And there were lots of hydraulics and just interesting, you know, ropes and people. And I think I got caught up, and that's where I really wanted to get into the technical side. I really want to be an actor at all. I did a little bit of acting. I'm actually a Screen Actor Guild actor because I brought up in a movie or two, and that's beside the point. But my drama teacher always wanted me to act. And, you know, to be honest with you, I'm queer. It's a little weird to be like, I never knew what roles would fit for me, you know, so I wound up in a movie that fit for me. I was in Monster with Charlize Theron. So I played one of the bar girls, you know.
Hold up. You were in Monster with Charlize Theron.
Yes, I had a small speaking role in Monster, which gave me my SAG card. So, and I've been in some other films, they're independent films, and they didn't really give me that opportunity. But, you know, having even you say four or five lines in a film, you're SAG eligible for the rest of your life. So, and I've, like I said, I've been in films that weren't anywhere near as important, but that one, at least I got some speaking time. So that makes a difference. It's a huge difference, by the way. I'll tell you that sometime. You know, it's like you get the lobster, everybody else gets the Kentucky Fried. So it's like really different. You can say two lies and you got a trailer. I mean, you know, it's like, okay,
there's a pecking order here, guys. There's a pecking order.
Like, look at me, you know, like I'm a big deal. But yeah, so I like to always say, like, I make the joke of the fortunate son. You're like, I'm that person who like gets everything. I don't know what happens. I always somehow land on my feet. So I'll tell you why. I recently heard something my girlfriend told me, and my girlfriend's a white light healer and an empathic. And she believes she sees the dead. And I think she's probably does. She's completely nuts. But I love her to death. She's beautiful and crazy. But
said with love, of course.
Yes, with love. I say with love. You know, she's awesome, actually. But I've always wondered, you know, my uncle was like everything to me. You know, I remember when I was a kid, he used to come to my house every night and have dinner with us. And I always thought he was in love with my mother, and he got married. He'd come back from the war. He got married right away, and he killed himself 5 weeks later. And I always wondered, because he was always at my house, nothing inappropriate. I mean, I was there. But in fact, somebody told my dad, your wife's cheating on you while you're at work. This guy's coming in. He said, do you ever notice how much he looks just like me? He's my younger brother. So she told me recently, very recently, that I said, it really upset me that he left me. You know, he walked away from, if nothing else, live for me. You know, we were, you know, he's my favorite person in the world. And she said, he never left you. He's right there. Like, he's always been here. And that might be why I'm lucky. That might be why. You know, maybe he's always been, you know, when you say I have a guardian angel, I might just have one.
Oh, definitely. So, definitely. So, yeah. And yeah. Just the feeling that you kind of know that you've got your guardian angel, you've got your uncle there, and yeah, he's looking out for you. He's got your back, right? He's not going to let anything happen to you. I love that. So
she's crazy enough to be right. She's crazy enough to be right. You know, she really might be. So it kind of makes sense. So yeah, I've done all these weird things, and I've somehow always landed on my feet with it. So it's pretty interesting, you know.
So you've lived all these amazing lives. So kind of. Talk us into getting into the music and things like this, because I've only discovered that you were an accomplished drummer and vocalist. What
yes.
Was that through NYU? What's happened there?
Started in high school, actually. I was 13 when I went to high school. I was literally the youngest person in the building when I walked through the doors the first day. And I didn't know too many people. A bunch of senior girls took me under their wing. They thought I was a cute little thing, I guess, or whatever. And they befriended me. And somewhere in the middle of it, I realized I don't like getting up in the morning. I still don't. I got up early for you.
Thank you.
terrible. Because, again, back to the watching movies all night. I was up all night. And just before I started high school, my father's mom died in our house. And she had a form of leukemia and wind up living with us to the end and in the room next to me. So I couldn't sleep at all. I would stay up all night and now watch movies. I wait till the sun comes up and fall asleep for an hour or two. So I'm always late. So that's maybe why I'm a musician. I'm going somewhere with this. So the band director was looking for more people to be in the band. And he said, you can be late for homeroom anytime you want if you join the band. So I wound up in the band homeroom. So I could be late. And he never called me late. I could show up like 10 or 15 minutes late, show up just barely in time to make it to school. And I could hide out in the band room when I didn't feel like going to school at all. This is something he's already, thank God, been fired. So I could tell you the story. And the next band director passed. But I had a room of my own there, basically. And if I just didn't feel like going, I stole the couch from the theater department. I had two guys and said, there's a couch over there across the hall in the theater. Go take it. They stuffed it in a room for me and I set up a card table and I would have poker games and just crash in my room in the bedroom with my name on it. Don't come in. And I would just not go to class. Sometimes I show up, I would say to my teacher, I'm not here today. Mark me absent. And he would, and I would hold a poker game with the guys and we just kind of hang out. And yeah, it was fun. So I made the best
rock and roll lifestyle.
Yeah. So I wound up, and I didn't know what I wanted to play. He wanted me to play flute. I'm like, oh God, no. So I said, let's try drums. And I started playing drums. And my dad, I had such an aptitude for it. I think if you want to talk about an idiot savant, I might be an idiot savant in drumming or just an idiot. But I burned through three teachers inside of a year. They just looked at my father and said, I can't teach this kid anything else. She's already playing better than I am. Wow. You're going to have to find somebody better. So by the time I was going, I think just a little, about 14 and a half, like I said, I went burning through them. We got with a guy named Sonny Igo, who's a very famous drummer. He was in the 50s and 40s and 50s. He played with Woody Herman and Benny Goodman. And he had, his hands had swollen with arthritis and he couldn't play as much. He started teaching. He was very expensive. And my old man coughed up the money and sent me to study with him. And I studied with him for about 4 years. Jazz drumming for the most part. And I think the singing really came from, I had a crush on a girl. I'm dating them. But she said, we needed people in the chorus to come sing. I never sang in my life. I didn't know I could. I had no idea I could sing. Turns out I have what they call relative pitch, which is basically perfect pitch. It's just that I can't necessarily always identify the exact note. Most of the time I can. But I can't, but I, if you play a note, I will play it. I will sing it back perfectly. And I could hear if something is this much off flat or sharp. So it's called relative pitch. So they were like, oh, okay, you're in the chorus. So I started singing and eventually wound up, you know, in bands together, like all high school kids do. And eventually did that for a living for a while, you know, playing drums and singing. So kind of what I always did. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. So. No, a lot of fun things.
It does sound like a lot of fun. So how did you end up being a CEO of a publishing company? Because that's a big leap.
It's a big leap. I like to say I have the dream job I never knew I wanted. So when I was probably 19 or 20, my dad was an accomplished technical writer. He wrote a very well-received eighth grade science textbook, but he wasn't a writer like fiction. And I was writing fiction and I gave him some stuff I must have been 19 or 20. And he said, don't quit your day job. You're a better drummer than you are a writer. Go do other things. Go to the theater. This isn't you. You're not good. And I love my dad, but he was a little autistic, I think. And he was like, I trusted him. And I said, well, I guess I suck. But I kept writing for fun. And I put it aside. And I did a lot of drumming and a lot of playing music. And I did a lot of theater. I wound up running my own theater company for a long while. And, you know, all kinds of stuff happened. So, and I love the theater. I still worship theater and movies, film, love film. So long time goes by and I met a young lady and we got very involved with one another and she was a fantastic writer. And we had an idea for a story and she said, well, why don't you try writing it? And I did, and I sucked. And she was very honest and kind. And she said, you know, she loved me. She said, good start, bad writing, try again. And she'd show me what to do. And I started writing. She says, now you're on track. And I just kept practicing, getting better. And then I thought, you know, maybe I'll write plays. Theater, writing, let's put those two together. Mm-hmm. I wrote a one-act play. We produced it. Everybody loved it. I wrote another play. Then I wrote another play. Then I don't know. So I started writing plays. And all of them wound up getting produced locally in our area. I got into film theater festivals. And they got accepted into festivals. We did them, you know, won some prizes. So that kind of thing. And eventually it morphed into my writing, nonfiction and even some fiction. So long story longer, somehow or another, I wound up with a gentleman who owned a publishing company, and he was a ghostwriter. And we got friendly, and he asked me to be his business partner. And I was ghostwriting for him at a very, very cheap rate. Wasn't getting paid very much, but it was in addition to my company. So my other work that I do. And he got cancer. He got throat cancer with 8 books ready to be published. Wow. Couldn't hold his head up, sick as a dog. He said, you got to help me. You got to do this. So I got tossed into the fire. We had 8 books that had to be out inside of 6 weeks or 8 weeks. And I realized we were doing everything wrong. There wasn't one thing we were doing right as a publishing company. So in those 8 to 10 weeks, I managed to get them all published, got them all book signings, and I found all the right people. And when he got better, he really wasn't up for my being part of the company anymore because he wanted to come back and take everything over. And I had at that point was running the company. And we came to an agreement that he would pay me some of what he owed me, not all of it because he couldn't afford me. And I started my own company. And I continued to ghostwrite and publish, and it just got bigger and bigger and better. So it's going along pretty nicely. So that's what I do.
It is going along pretty nicely because you have been the force behind and the publisher behind so many acclaimed authors and Amazon number one authors. And how many books and authors do you think you've collaborated with now?
Over the course of the last working with being the vice president of a different company and then the president and the CEO of this one, 60 maybe.
Wow,
somewhere in there. I've personally written probably 18 or so of them, maybe 20, and then published. Those are not all, you know, all the same, but yeah, I've either written or developed or personally written, well into the dozens, and we've put out so many books. This year alone, like just this last month or two, we've put out about 6 or 7 books. So it's just getting, you know, it's snowballing. So
what would you say to somebody who's thinking of doing a book or a collaborative book, or they've got all these stories, you know, stashed away in their drawer at home that they want to kind of publish? What would you say to them to really get started?
You know, you got to start where you are. I always say begin where you are. So if you have ideas and you can't write, then you hire people like us. Obviously, we come and help you and figure out how to make the writing good. But your ideas are yours. We want to make sure that your ideas are out there in the world. If you're a decent writer and you know you're a decent writer, get a coach. We have coaches on the staff, and you know, we can help you take what you've got. We got one from one of our books that I'm coaching right now, and she's a terrific writer. She just can't organize her thoughts the way I can because I'm doing this so much. And she's, oh my God, I didn't think of that. Oh my God, oh yeah, okay. So accountability. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, you got to get this done. You got 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks, we're going to meet. What are you going to get done? And she's got her outline. And especially with business and nonfiction books, outlining is imperative. You have to have a very good outline. It's like trying to color without the coloring. It's, you know, it's like paint by numbers once you've done that. You know? So once you have a strong outline and subtitles for that outline, you've broken that outline into nice little bits, then you go back and you start to fill, color it in, right? So that's what I suggest with that. And if you're going to do business books, please tell some stories. Don't just give dry business advice. No one cares. Everyone knows how to sell something their own way. And that's all good stuff. But tell stories of how you got somebody to be a great salesman by using your techniques. And now they own a nice house and a car. And, you know, they came from making 10 bucks an hour at the Publix, you know, whatever it is. That's our store here. Sorry, Publix is like our grocery store. Like McDonald's.
Okay. I was going to ask what a Publix was. Yeah.
What is a Publix? Okay. But it's the place where you get the good subs. So, yep. It's sandwiches. So anyway, I recommend that. And then if the book is great and you think it's perfect, it's not. Get an editor. Get somebody to proofread it beside you to look at it and say, there's some holes here, or there's some things wrong, or your grammar needs work. Because no matter how good you think it is, there's a pretty good chance having someone edit it for you, or at least proofread it before you go publish it. And then you come and talk to me about publishing, and I'll be happy to tell you the different ways you can publish and what you need to do that, whether you work with us or someone else, or not, or do it yourself. But that's then you want to get it up. Traditional publishing is really difficult. So if you have something very unique and a very, very large group of people who will buy it off the bat, you have a shot at traditional publishing. But there's really only 4 major publishers in the world. And if you count Amazon, 5. And that's it. And getting in with them is very difficult. So self-publishing of any nature has become popular for that reason. But you got to market and follow up and do those things. Got to have a plan. I guess the truth is I'm boiling it down to you need a plan.
Yeah, so 100%. And you've got a lot of life lessons and a lot of experience, and especially coming from such a creative background of writing and theater and plays, and, you know, and you're a business person. Like, you're a business person. And I love how you injected kind of, you got to tell your stories, right? And you just pull it all together. You put it in a nice little package box and you deliver the goods. You teach people another aspect of them, because sometimes we can't write the beginning chapters of our books, but we can, like you did with, growing up the way you did, but we can always write the end chapters of our books, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it is true. And I think you have to look at, you know, if you want to write a memoir, because you think it'll, I mean, we have a lot of memoir writers, but my platform this year is writing for the greater good. And I really believe that we need to write and work and live for the greater good. We don't want to put out books that nobody cares about, and that just because you say, look, it's my calling card. I'm a mortgage rep. Okay. Tell me the stories of how, because you're a mortgage rep, you got someone who went from poverty into a home of their own. Tell me that story. You know, tell me how you're going to help me and somebody else, or someone who can't manage, or whatever it might be. And we've had some tremendous stories, and they don't want to just write these books, our authors, just to say, to purge of their life. Oh, this happened to me. They want to go out and speak. They want to go out and affect other people's lives. They want to go and talk to young women who've been molested, or to mothers of those women who have to deal with it, or people who came from, I have one lady writing a book right now called Rounding the Curves, and she's in Utah, and there's a lot of curves in Utah. And I actually came up with the title. She's very pleased. But she was at a seminar of mine in Utah, and she's in her 60s. She's 57, I think. Beautiful woman. And she said, I don't even know why I'm at this seminar. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't want to write anything. I'm not sure if I want to work. I don't know what I lost my job. I'm upset. And I just looked at her and I said, you're not done. And she said, what? I said, you're not done. Stand up and say, I'm not done, as loud as you can. And she did. Mm-hmm. She stood up. She said, I'm not done. I said, you're not done. Everybody says, is she done? Everybody said, no, she's not done. And all these people, you're not done. She's written 70,000 words. We're about to publish her first book. Her and I are working on the first one, and we'll be publishing it probably in a month or two. And that was less than a year ago. And I'm really proud of her. So, and she's had a tough row of it. And she wants to go out and speak to people about resilience and the things that she's been through, my goodness, and raising 6 or 7 kids, I forget how many, and they're all doing great. They're all alive. She got them all to the finish line there, and despite motorcycle accidents and all these things. So we want to get people to do that kind of thing and tell their story in that manner. 100%. And, you know, I take it very seriously. I had a woman yesterday tell me that I'm not as professional as she is. I take everything very casually. And I said, well, that's insulting. And on top of that, you don't clearly don't know me. I'm serious as a heart attack, but I'll have fun while I'm doing it. And if you don't have fun while you're doing it,
you're doing it wrong.
Doing it wrong altogether. So we had a little come to Jesus about that. But yeah, I look like I'm casual. I look like I'm silly and goofy, but I take what I do incredibly seriously. And I'm very proud of my writers. They're wonderful people. Almost all of them are really wonderful people.
That's absolutely amazing, because it can really transform. It can almost be like a form of therapy for some people if they're writing their memoirs too, you know, leaving that legacy, letting future generations know where they've come from as well. So they're going to pick up this book and kind of go, wow, didn't know that about Nana, you know? Wow, right. Is this really where we came from? We were once homeless living in a car. What the heck? You know, isn't that amazing that we can pick up a book? So, you know, just like you were a 13-year-old getting on the bus going to watch theatre, you know, there's probably some 13-year-old getting on the bus to go to the biggest library and just sit there and just escape into books, right? And it's just we need that connection. We need an outlet. We need that creativity. We need to be able to see something bigger and use our imagination, right? Not just sit there and Netflix and chill and zone out and not use the old ticker, right? We need to be able to really retain that, especially with things moving along in technology. But what do you think about those kind of things as well? Like, you know, just really getting back to our creativeness, because that's where we were when we were that little 7-year-old girl, right? That's where we were. We used to play and we used to imagine, and no matter what we went through, there was always that creativeness, and we kind of lose that crap somewhere when we grow up sometimes, right? So just bringing it back to really connecting with ourselves again.
America has taken a very odd turn. I don't know what it's like where you are, but I can tell you that we have at least last 6 years or so, maybe a little longer, have turned away from the arts a great deal. We're pushing kids and we're pushing money, and we've become so money oriented. People are upside down. They're in debt a great deal and they're constantly struggling. And I think they escape into video games and Netflix binging, because there's one common thread that's happening probably worldwide. You can tell me if it's in Australia, certainly in America. And the common thread comes down to one word: despair. We're all in despair. We're in despair and we don't know what to do. When you're in despair, you know, I think we're having collective depression. And when you're in despair, you just look for anything to numb your mind. Video games numb your mind. Great films bring thoughts to your head. They introduce ideas. Great books introduce ideas, concepts. Playing with children is creative, doing something physical, being outside and doing physical things. When I was a kid, we went skateboarding, we played basketball, we played volleyball. We all summer long, the parks had things for us to do. We go down and I took archery up. Why archery? I don't know. It seemed like a fun thing, but they had it free. They had stuff I could go and do. And we need to get kids out the door to go do some actual things like that. And I think we're just having a really hard time being in despair over everything that's going on at one time. It's too much for the human mind to take on. So books, you know, books are great. And I think I always say I wanted to start my story when I write my memoir. I was going to start my story with my uncle jumping off a building publicly in front of the whole world. Oh, my goodness. Right. I didn't start it there. I actually started it with my dad giving me a book when I was about 14. He threw this book at me and he said, if you can get through the first 50 pages, they're a little boring. Wade through them. But if you can get through them, this book will change your life. And he was right. Son of a gun that he was. I don't know if they'll curse him or laugh. But he gave me a book called The Razor's Edge by William Somerset Maugham.
Oh my God, you are not going to believe this. I'm sorry just booked that. I literally 2 or 3 weeks ago at a garage sale, I literally just picked up a secondhand copy of that book.
Read it, and it will change your life. And what happened to me, I think, at 14 is I read that book and I thought, this guy's right. This is the way to live. And it's one of the most impressive stories you'll ever see. There's an old movie with Tyrone Power, and I've seen the movie. And there's a more recent one with can think who is it? One of the more recent actors, but it wasn't very good. The first one actually maybe doesn't follow the story perfectly, but it's a much better film. But it basically, in a lot of ways, it's one guy's search and journey to find God in his own way, to find whatever God is to you, and to live his life authentically, as opposed to, he had the opportunity to make a ton of money, marry the woman he was in love with, work for her father in banking or something. And instead, he chose to live his life in a very random and eclectic and unusual way. And I wound up doing exactly that. And it occurred to me not that long ago that this is all my father's fault. So he was never mad at me for the life I led. I think he was admired me a great deal. And that was good. But if something interesting showed up, if I saw an interesting thing to do, I went and did it. Mm. If I wanted to do something crazy, I did it. I'm still traveling and I'm nomadic in a lot of ways and I do what I want to do. And will I be a millionaire? I don't know, maybe in the end, but does it matter? And if I was, I'd give half of it away anyway. save yourself and the world will follow, man. I mean, that's what happens. And that's a quote of mine. So I think you have to do that. And if whatever it is, you're going to help other people and do what you need to do. And then you can help everybody else. So, yeah, I think that book really changed my life.
Definitely going to read those 50 pages as soon as I can. And that's just amazing. You know, the universe delivers again, right? The universe always sends us what we need. They always. It's absolutely amazing that you just sent chills through me when you said that. And it's not a book I would have normally picked up either, right? It's just kind of like it just looked interesting. I thought, okay. And it's all dog-eared and old. And I thought, I got to have that.
Yeah, I read it every now and again just to remind myself that I did the right thing. So fantastic. I kind of even wrote a play. I even wrote a play about my first major play that I wrote was kind of based on that idea, in a way that this guy was living the wrong life. And he at the end of the play makes a decision to do his own thing, you know? So,
well, we only get one chance of it while we're here, right? So we've got to do what our heart desires. And it's not about the material things. It's about living your best life and just waking up every day and just being happy, right?
As happy as you can be, you know, and if you're not happy, figure it out and do something else. But as long as you can feed yourself and your family and got a roof over your head as best you can, you're doing okay. The rest of 100%. It falls into place, you know.
Oh, I just love your wisdom and your perspective on everything. So you're doing amazing things. We're going to share where to connect with you. What kind of message would you like to leave the audience on today?
Yes, and I'd love for people to connect with me. So you're going to send them my Calendly link. I never mind to talk to people wherever you are with a book or you want to publish a book. Or we do a lot of anthologies. If you got a group of people who want to write together, we like to say, friends, don't let friends write alone. And it's a nice thing for charities, especially, to do. We have a wonderful out of the box program for that. So if you're interested in that, we make it really easy for people to do that.
Might even have a collaborative book, I think. There's a few stories that need to be shared around for a legacy.
That'd be wonderful. Yeah, we have one coming out next week called Life by Design that Kim Ward group got together and wrote. And we do that all the time. And I set it up so that, especially for charities, they don't have to put any money out. They can get started, see how it goes. And if they don't get it together, they don't. But if they don't have to worry about spending anything until they make something. So I've got that worked out really nicely. I guess my message is such that, you know, if you think about other people, if you write for the greater good, you live for the greater good, you work for the greater good, and not just for yourself and be selfish, that I promise you, you're going to, in one way or the other, you're going to be a success. And if you don't, I promise you, one way or the other, you're going to be a failure. And that's pretty much my belief. And I may never be a millionaire, like I said, but I think I'm going to be a success in that I really believe in people and I believe in books and I believe in the arts. And let's get that to be the mantra for the next few years and try to get us out of these misery and despair that we're in. To try to just, I think the arts can drag us from that and remind us that there's something worth living for.
100%. I totally agree. You're inspirational. You're changing so many lives. Everybody, we are going to share where to connect with Lil because she is an absolute phenomenon. She's going to direct you. She's going to give you inspiration. She's going to tell you like it is, tell you sometimes what you need to hear and sometimes probably what you don't want to hear, but you need to hear.
And that a few times.
To get you on the right track as well. So if you're thinking of starting a book, writing a memoir, having a collaboration book, please get in contact with Lil because she's literally saving and changing lives. And what a wonderful legacy to leave future generations if you actually deliver a book and your children's children can pick that up and say, my great-grandma or my great-grandpa wrote this. And this is where we come from, you know, if it's that type of book. And Lil can help you with that. So we're going to share out to where to connect with her. Thanks for really sharing your story. I'm learning more and more about you. And I love your honesty. You can find the Victim to Victory podcast series on Apple, Spotify, and our YouTube. Don't forget to subscribe and share this out onto your socials and look out for Brand Your Story Academy, where we teach you how to tell your story on podcasts and virtual stages. Connect with Lil and she'll show you how to put it into a book as well. Thank you very much.